Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we're back from our weekend, and I do mean all of us, even Joel and Katie, who, as you may recall from last week, were gearing up to run in the New York City half marathon yesterday. Well, they did it. And Joel is categorically denying rumors that he was seen hailing a cab around mile 9. Many of you were part of the team that got them over the finish line, because all last week, we were assembling your suggestions for a running playlist. And we've posted that playlist on soundcheck.org. So next time you feel the need to run from one place to another place that's over 13 miles away, you can do it on Wings of Song.
Hi, this is Fred from Armada, Michigan, and I think you should listen to Technologic by Daft Punk for the running playlist.
Technologic, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it.
Hello, my name is Francisco. I live in Stamford, Connecticut, and my favorite song for running is Smashing Pumpkins, Mayonnaise, the acoustic version.
Joe Mecca calling, living in Paramus, New Jersey. The song is Police on My Back by The Clash. Thank you.
It's actually a great song to run to, isn't it? Of course, that assumes that music moves you. But it turns out not everyone who can hear music responds to it. In a moment, we'll hear about a study of a curious condition called musical anhedonia, the inability to enjoy music. One of the neuroscientists behind the study will explain, and will offer you a chance to take the musical anhedonia questionnaire on soundcheck.org. No question that Michael Dorff likes music. He founded the popular down-and-dirty music venue The Knitting Factory back in the 80s, and the much more upscale venue City Winery 20 years later. He'll tell us about the changing life of a music impresario in a changing New York City. But first, songwriter Liam Finn is going to give us a live performance with his band. Liam's from New Zealand, from a famous family of musicians, in fact. But he's based here in New York, and we'll get a chance to talk with him and hear a set of tunes later in the show. For now, here he is playing a song called Ocean Emmanuel. It's Liam Finn, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you. stand a chance that you're leaving. I've decided that I won't let you.
That's the singer-songwriter Liam Finn from New Zealand with his band, kicking off the show with a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. Stick around, because he's sticking around, and we'll hear more from him later in the show. There's a reason we humans have been making music for millennia, because most of us really, really like it. Our brains respond to music positively, and in turn, we feel good when we listen to it. But a recent study shows that some people, in fact, somewhere around 2% of the population, don't feel anything when listening to music. Dr. Robert Zatori is a neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University. He was involved in the study and joins us now on Soundcheck. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
So when you started working on this project, was it your assumption that everybody likes music?
Well, it was indeed our assumption, and at some point we realized that it was an assumption and that it had never been tested. And so, you know, being scientifically minded, we thought, gee, we should really verify if our assumptions are correct.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you go about doing that?
Well, the first step was to develop a questionnaire. So we thought, if there are people who don't necessarily like music, we need to identify them. And so we came up with a questionnaire that addresses how much value people obtain from music. So it asks questions like, you know, if you have a music collection of recordings, mm-hmm. or how much money you spend, or whether you often share music with your friends, or do you go to concerts.
Now, that's just the first step. But listeners, you can find a link to that first step, this questionnaire, on our website at soundcheck.org. So once you got the results of this questionnaire back, what was the next step?
So the next step was to be sure that people who scored very low on that questionnaire didn't have some other explanation for it. So for example, if someone responds, you know, negatively to all those questions, it could be that they just have some kind of generalized depression, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
or that they have what psychiatrists would call anhedonia, which is just a general, you know, inability to derive pleasure from other things in life.
Right.
And then furthermore, we also made sure that they didn't have some kind of perceptual problem. So there are people who are tone deaf or who have amusia and who just can't perceive music in a normal way. And so it wouldn't be surprising if those people didn't really care for music because they can't hear it correctly. And so we eliminated anyone who, you know, had one of those other conditions. And we were still left with about a 2% of our group who were perfectly normal in every possible way. Their personalities are normal. They're not depressed. They don't have any problem hearing or anything else. And yet they just don't really care for music.
And how do you measure that? I mean, you have some kind of physiological way of measuring our response to music.
Yes, right? That's right. So we wanted to move beyond just the answers to questions, because people might give all kinds of strange answers, and we wanted to see if the physiology was in line with what they were telling us on these questionnaires. So we developed a test where we measure heart rate and skin conductance, which is basically how sweaty your palms are. And so we gave people music that we thought everyone should respond to. And we had a control group of people who had sort of normal scores on our questionnaire. We had a group of people who had very low scores. We also had a group who showed sort of hyper hedonic responses, people who absolutely are crazy about music. And what we found is that in response to music, the people who scored very low, that is those who told us, you know, I really don't enjoy music much, they weren't lying to us. Their physiology was absolutely flat. They just didn't get any response at all from these musical pieces, whereas everyone else responded as we would expect.
So one of those pieces played for the group was this excerpt from the music to the film Schindler's List by John Williams. That is some of the music from Schindler's List by John Williams. It was part of the musical survey that Dr. Robert Satori and his colleagues played for a group of people. They were students at the University of Barcelona, right, Robert?
That's correct, yes.
And so looking for a specific kind of anhedonia. You mentioned before, Robert, anhedonia is a kind of general inability to take pleasure from things that most of us find pleasurable. Your study talks about what is called specific musical anhedonia. So the results of playing this music for these people basically were no results. You didn't get any kind of skin response, any kind of, you know, galvanic response from the measurements that you were taking, right?
That's right. They were basically flat in response to that music, which everyone else finds, you know, poignant and beautiful and very emotional.
Well, now let me ask you. I mean, there are a bunch of college kids. Suppose they're into, you know, David Guetta or punk rock, or, you know, they're used to listening to a serious kind of four on the floor dance music or whatever.
Sure, sure. Well, so in fact, the list of music that we used was selected by an independent group of students at the same university. And so we were, you know, trying to find music that would have general appeal to that particular age group and cultural group. And indeed, we had basically three groups. The first group selected the music. The second group was a control group that responded to the music that the first group had selected. And then the third group were the ones that had been tagged as being musically anhedonic. And they were all similar in terms of their age, their background, their socioeconomic status, the language they spoke, etc. And so they have a shared culture with the other people, and yet they still didn't respond to the music. Interestingly, though, when we asked them to describe what the music was meant to convey, they were spot on with that. They had no problem saying, you know, well, this music is sad, that music is happy, this is dance music. We did have some different kinds of styles there. So they understand the implied meaning of the music. They can verbalize it. They just don't feel it.
Huh. So, and as you said before, that makes this different from amusia, which is a neurological condition where people just cannot, the brain just doesn't process the sound correctly, and it's just gobbledygook as opposed to music. This group understands the music, just isn't feeling it.
Correct. Yes, exactly.
Wow. Listeners, what do you think? Do you or maybe someone you know have musical anhedonia? Leave us a message at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Satori, neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University, about this group of people, approximately 2% of the population, who don't feel anything emotional connected to music. Now, are you able to test, Robert, that these people can in fact feel hedonic, you know, feel pleasure to other things?
Yes, this was a very important part of our study, is to demonstrate that their reward system is functioning. It's just not functioning for music. And so the way we did that was basically by getting them to play a kind of a little video game. It's like a gambling game where you have to guess certain numbers that are coming on the screen. And usually you win just a few cents. But every so often, you get a big payout. So I think in our experiment, the participants were getting like €2 in an unexpected way.
Uh-huh.
And so when you're playing this game and you suddenly get the large sum of money, it's actually very exciting. And
you were able to measure that. That response was measurable.
Yeah, so we could measure the skin response and the heart rate to that. And our people who are musically anhedonic respond to the money just as well as everyone else.
Huh.
So, you know, they love money, but they just don't love music.
So when they're listening to Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, they know it's supposed to be happy. They know how other people feel about it. They're just not feeling it. Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. It's a pretty familiar piece of music, and one of the pieces that Dr. Robert Satori and his colleagues played for a bunch of students at the University of Barcelona in their search for the portion of our population that has specific musical anhedonia, a term for people who hear music, hear it properly, just don't respond to it. The study is called Dissociation Between Musical and Monetary Reward Responses in Specific Musical Anhedonia. You can find a link to the survey, the questionnaire that began the study, on our website at soundcheck.org. So, Robert, you came down to the conclusion that about 2% of your population there had some form of musical anhedonia. Does that seem to bear out? I mean, have you been able to extrapolate from that to the general population?
Well, of course, it depends on how you define it, and it's there is a range of responses. There are people who are on the really low end, and those are the ones that we selected for our study because, you know, we were looking for the sort of purest version.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also people who are, you know, sort of on the borderline, who may listen to some music occasionally, but, you know, it's not a big deal
right
for them.
I guess I'm kind of wondering if there are people out there who have had this and have sort of been hiding it because it's, you know, kind of not cool when all your friends are so into music and you're sitting there wondering, well, what's wrong with me? I just don't get it. And then the survey comes out. I'm just wondering if you've been besieged with people going, finally, someone can tell me what's wrong with me.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've had a number, since the paper was published, I've had a number of, you know, random emails from people that I don't know who they are exactly, but they write to me and say, this describes me to a T. I've been, you know, trying to tell other people that I just, you know, I'm not that interested in music, and they don't understand why. And so I'm so happy to know that there are others out there who are similar, you know, have a similar situation to me.
So if they don't love music, does that also mean they don't hate it?
You know, that's a very good question. It's something we want to investigate now, is if we find music that most people find really annoying, will these folks fail to respond negatively to it. I suspect that that is, in fact, what will happen.
All right. Well, I guess that'll be the next go-round. In the meantime, listeners, do you think you or someone you know might have musical anhedonia? Give us a call at 866-939-1612, our soundcheck listener hotline, 866-939-1612, or leave a comment on the website, soundcheck.org. The bigger question here, Robert, is, you know, what's going on in the brain? How can this very specific kind of study help us understand the brain and human behavior better?
That's right. So, you know, the reason we do these kinds of studies is really because we're trying to understand the function of the brain and specifically the function of the reward system, which is this mechanism that we have, which allows us to evaluate the importance and significance of different stimuli and their emotional value. And I always think that if you just look in a newspaper at some of the big problems that we have in society, many of them are related to some kind of dysregulation of the reward system. So if you look at things like drug addiction or things like eating disorders or gambling, people who have problems with gambling or you know video games, etc., many times it's either a hyper activation of this reward system or sometimes hypoactivation, like in the case of depression. So by studying this very particular circumstance, I think we gain some insight into the way that the reward system works, and in particular, in the way in which the reward system interacts with the rest of the brain. Because what we think is happening with these folks is that their perceptual system, the part of the brain that responds to incoming sound, is somehow decoupled from the part of the brain that evaluates the significance of those sounds.
All right. Well, in the meantime, listeners, you can find a link to the survey about your sort of emotional response to music on the website at soundcheck.org. It's the same survey that Dr. Robert Satori and his colleagues in Barcelona used. Robert is a neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University. He's been with us on Soundcheck today. Robert, it's a fascinating study. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Up next, more from today's musical guest, the New Zealand-born singer-songwriter Liam Finn, son of Neil Finn from Crowded House and Split Enz. Liam and his band will play songs from his new record, and later we'll hear from New York music impresario Michael Dorff talking about paying tribute to the music of Paul Simon. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Singer-songwriter Liam Finn is from New Zealand, but his new album, The Nihilist, due out at the beginning of May, took shape in Brooklyn, where he's been living these last few years. You can catch him actually honing his new batch of songs every Tuesday in Brooklyn in March at a residency of concerts. But today, Liam Finn and his band are here in the Soundcheck studio, and they're going to give us a preview of some of that new material. Here is Liam Finn and his band performing a live version of a song called Snug As.
When you hung me up, when my heart dried out, just like the fruit on a windowsill. Thank you.
That is music from Liam Finn, originally from New Zealand, but now based here in New York. That song is called Snug As, and you'll find it eventually on Liam Finn's new record, The Nihilist, which is due out in May, but we're getting a bit of a preview of it here in the Soundcheck studio. Liam Finn singing and playing electric guitar. Good to see you with a full band this time.
Good to be here with a full band.
Eliza Jane Barnes playing electric guitar, some backing vocals. CeCe Herbert on keyboard, some backing vocals. Matt Eccles on bass, and brother Elroy Finn on drums. Last time you were here, Liam, you were doing the one-man band thing with the looping and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
In the making of this record, was it a band record from the beginning, or did it start with you and the loops and the tracking and all that kind of stuff?
It started as a band thing. I mean, we moved to New York after touring my last record for a while, and all of us were kind of at that point it was just EJ and Elroy and a friend of mine, Joel, playing bass, and we all set up camp in Greenpoint and I started writing songs alone, but I started writing songs with these guys, and I intended the whole thing to be a really quite live performed record, and we kind of embarked that way and actually almost finished a record very quickly with it sounding quite simple. And then it didn't really capture that sort of atmosphere that I was getting on some of the demos, and I had this vision for what I wanted this record to be, and it was a lot more
nihilist.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I've never heard it called nihilist, and I thought that was almost a Freudian slip, but I thought it was nihilist, but I could be wrong. I think there's no you know, I've heard different ways. I've heard nihilist as well, as it's spelt. But nihilist, God, that's I might have thought twice.
But the thing is, as titles go, it's a bit of a misnomer, because this does not sound like a very nihilist record. This is some of the most kind of, you know, rockin' and ravin' music that you've done, it seems.
I guess my interpretation of nihilism isn't particularly as dark and as morbid as a lot of people's. I mean, a lot of people don't seem to know even what it is that I've talked to, and then the people that do know what it is seem to have been brought up maybe with it being a bit more of a religious connotation or a spiritual connotation, uh-huh, where someone believes in absolute nothing and
right,
that it's a big black vortex of nothingness. And
so explain to me your kinder, gentler nihilism.
Well, I guess I wouldn't say it's gentler, but it's more a lot this idea of an extreme skepticism, and
okay,
that maybe that, you know, what we've been brought up to believe and what we're conditioned to sort of take for reality, and, you know, in this day and age, is potentially completely untrue. You know,
mm-hmm,
I think we're all almost in agreement with that these days, no matter where you sit.
Anyone,
you know,
who's seen The Matrix.
There you go, yeah. I mean, that, you know, that opened people's eyes up to possibilities. But I think in general, you know, what we're seeing on TV, or what we're sort of being taught from parents and grandparents, is actually in some ways potentially a full reality. It's a facade of what, you know, what's really going on up there. And I don't think we really know what's going on. So I like the idea of exploring that in music.
Yeah. The album is due on May 6th. I will probably continue to call it The Nihilist when Liam is not here, but since he's my guest, I'll say Nihilist for the moment. Liam Finn and the band performing live on Soundcheck. Here is a real barn burner from the new record. This one is called Burn Up the Road. Burn Up the Road, the name of that song. Liam Finn, the singer and songwriter and guitarist, with Eliza Jane Barnes on guitar and vocals, CeCe Herbert playing keyboards, Matt Eccles on bass, Elroy Finn behind the drum kit. The album that he's calling The Nihilist comes out on May 6th. All of these songs are on it. Their residency is every Tuesday night in the month of March at Union Pool in Brooklyn. You'll have a chance to hear him and the band working out these new songs. Liam, it's been great seeing you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Listen to this segment as a podcast with more conversation from Liam Finn about the new album, The Nihilist or Nihilist. Just go to soundcheck.org. Depending on your perspective, Michael Dorff is the guy behind the original Knitting Factory nightclub, or the guy behind the City Winery venue, or the guy who presents a star-studded music tribute concert at Carnegie Hall each year. All three Michael Dorffs will visit us for a conversation next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Michael Dorff is the founder of two well-established music venues here in New York. First, the Knitting Factory, and now City Winery, right across the street from our studios. For the last 10 years, Michael has also organized an annual tribute concert at Carnegie Hall, where each year he recruits musicians to sing their favorite songs from one legendary artist's catalog. Ticket sales go to youth music education here in the city. This year, the 10th year of these concerts, honors Paul Simon. And Michael Dorff joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Hey.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've already done a Simon and Garfunkel tribute, didn't you?
Yeah, it was a little different.
Not at Carnegie Hall.
It was at Central Park Summer Stage. And when they asked me to help them with a gala, they said, what do you think would be appropriate for the park? And the first thing that came to mind was, you know, the classic Simon and Garfunkel in the park. So I gave them that one, and they said, okay, see if you can do it. And actually both Art and Paul came to that show, which was kind of cool.
Now, are you expecting or hoping that Paul will come to this show?
We always say the honoree is not going to come, but we have had some great times. Bruce Springsteen came to his tribute, and he actually played a couple songs at the end, and people freaked out. And REM came to their tribute, which was really, really cool. I remember Michael Stipe pulling me from the side of stage to the end and holding my hand for the bow. It was a moment that I'll never forget. And yeah, we've had several things like that, so you never know what to expect.
How do you choose who the year's honoree is going to be?
Well, there's such an array of great songwriters out there. And on some level, I feel like a kid in a candy shop. I mean, I get to just think about who I love and then sequence it into the run of these things.
It also has to be somebody that you can find lots of people who are willing to find their own ways into the songs.
The idea is to have 20 artists interpret this great songbook, and you hear other components to the song. It's the same lyrics, but because of their intonation or just the way they recompose it, you actually start hearing things differently. In that sense, you think about a songbook that could have some reinterpretation.
Josh Ritter, Judy Collins, Betty LeVette, she's been on several of them.
She always brings the house down.
Angelique Kidjo.
Which will be very nice for some of that sort of world music repertoire.
Alan Toussaint. The house band will be Antibalas,
which would be a lot of fun.
Last year when you did Prince, the house band was The Roots.
That is correct.
So with Antibalas, you will be well-equipped to handle the Graceland period Paul Simon stuff.
And that seems to be a favorite of some of the songs that people are gravitating towards. That was a very strong period for Paul, and certainly seems to affect a lot of the artists.
We're speaking with Michael Dorff, whose annual tribute concert at Carnegie Hall this year is a celebration of the songs of Paul Simon. It's happening on March 31st, and you're likely to hear something like this.
She said, honey, take me dancing, but they ended up by sleeping in a doorway by the bodegas and the lights on over Broadway, wearing diamonds on the soles of their shoes. And I could say, ooh, and everybody here would know what I was talking about. I mean, everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about
Simon, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes from the Graceland album, Paul Simon's songbook, will be the subject at Carnegie Hall on March 31st, the annual tribute concert put together by Michael Dorff, who runs City Winery down here in Lower Manhattan, across the street from our studio. Michael didn't have to come far to be with us on Soundcheck today. The 10th year that you're doing this, and each year, the proceeds from the concert go to fund youth music education here in New York.
Yeah,
was that the starting point?
Yeah, it was. It originally, this thing came out of an organization that I was on the board, and they said, we need money. We got to raise some money. I said, let's do a show. And it was the music of Joni Mitchell. And they put it to me and said, well, you know, it could be risky and expensive. I said, here's the deal. I'll give 100% of the bottom line to the organization. If it loses money, I'll take the risk. And mm-hmm. It did really well. Then I realized that what they were doing was taking some of the funds and in their allocation covering overhead. So I kind of started directing the funds directly to some of those same organizations. So there's 8 or 9 different organizations, from Church Street School of Music down in Lower Manhattan to Music Unites to Mr. Holland's Opus. I mean, a whole variety that are doing great work. And so I take the proceeds and allocate. And this year, we make about $100,000 net each year.
Uh-huh.
This year, we probably will top the $1 million mark for the 10 years. Organizations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Michael, you've been on the New York scene for quite... I mean, I remember you and, you know, the rest of your posse coming from Wisconsin, starting the original Knitting Factory over on East Houston Street. It was a very different city back then, wasn't it?
It was, although I still feel like we could sneak some Pabst Blue Ribbon in a town like we did.
So did you bring any Wisconsin with you when you came to New York? And I mean, do we hear and see echoes of the Midwesterner at City Winery and the menu and the wine list?
It's just maybe someone who still wants to be part of what we imagine New York to be. And that's why I came, because I wanted to be, you know, part of that Jack Kerouac jazz club kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now I've, you know, certainly moved towards wanting to sit and listen to shows rather than stand for a show. And so the venue has evolved a little bit with where I am in my life cycle.
Right. But when you came here in the 80s, you were in your, like, early 20s.
I was 23 when I started to knit.
And what was the idea behind the Knitting Factory? It wasn't just, I'm going to open a jazz club.
No. In fact, the first name I had sitting in a cafe was Espressoism. You know, the idea was some sort of art and coffee and, you know, beer kind of place. Wednesdays was going to be poetry. Thursday was going to be jazz. Friday's performance art. Saturday's rock. And, you know, I have eclectic tastes and kind of wanted the place to reflect that.
Mm-hmm. So you've gone from, you know, wanting to stand at a show to wanting to sit at a show. And you've gone from wanting a beer at a show to wanting a nice glass of Chardonnay or Merlot.
Exactly. And not just a glass, but in real crystal, we use Riedel. We don't serve it in a plastic cup, and we're making wine, you know, across the street.
Right. Again, Michael Dorff, the founder of City Winery, which is a working winery as well as a very busy music venue here in Lower Manhattan. You got out of the Knitting Factory before the Knitting Factory moved to Brooklyn.
I did.
You moved it from East Houston Street to Leonard Street in Tribeca.
Right.
And then it moved eventually to Brooklyn. That was a result of, you know, gentrification, rising rents. These are all things you still have to deal with, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a smart move for them because they were trying to deal with the independent rock community, and that scene has moved a little bit more to Brooklyn.
So when the Knitting Factory finally did close here in Manhattan and move over to Brooklyn, closing night featured an array of bands that included this group, Akron Family.
We were rowed to sunny shores and start again. And oh, the wind blew across the bow and shook that vessel wildly. And you and I were cast into the waves. And though we can't deny the fear that grows of being swallowed whole, we will row to sunny shores and start again. Beneath another sky.
Another Sky from the band Akron Family. They were one of the bands on hand the night the Knitting Factory closed here in Manhattan and subsequently moving to Brooklyn. The Knitting Factory was opened back in the 80s by my guest Michael Dorf, who's with me on Soundcheck. He is the founder of City Winery across the street from our studios. It was 2004, Michael, that you started the tribute concerts,
yep.
The annual tribute
yep.
concerts. Why was youth education so important to you?
Several reasons, but one, and the reason why we're consistent with music education is it seems to be the stepchild of charities that always gets neglected. Mm. It gets neglected by the city. It gets neglected by fundraising because there's so many other things that happen all the time, weather-related and health-related, and it's something that is very, very necessary, and you can see the influence on kids and their staying in school and their improvements of math. I mean, there's a number of reasons why it's important, but it always seems to get neglected. So I just felt, you know, this is something that I could stay, you know, the course, and obviously it connects with putting on a show.
March 31st is this year's tribute concert at Carnegie Hall. It'll feature Josh Ritter and Betty Levette, Bob Mould, Angelique Kidjo, Madeleine Peyrou, and John Harrington of Steely Dan, and Alan Toussaint, Mike Gordon of Phish. March 31st, all of them paying tribute to Paul Simon at Carnegie Hall. Now, let me ask you, you've been here on the scene a long time. You've opened various venues. You've done various things. How hard would it be for a 23-year-old from Wisconsin to come to New York now and do what you did then?
Oh, boy, you've stumped me on that. I would say it would be very, very hard in Manhattan. Real estate has just become very, very huge, and the barriers to entry are very challenging. Certainly, it's happening in Brooklyn and other parts around, even upstate. I think you're seeing some really interesting art scenes. But to have the condensed audience and performers in one sort of focal point. I'm seeing it in Nashville right now. A lot of people are moving to Nashville.
So now you have a City Winery in Chicago already.
Yep.
And you're opening one in Napa Valley and one in Nashville?
Yeah, in the town of Napa. We've taken over the historic Opera House on Main Street in Napa. That opens in 3 weeks. Actually, our soft opening the day after this concert at Carnegie. And then Nashville, which is, it's not just a TV show, you know. There is a huge scene of rockers and blues artists, and it's not just country, and a plethora of studios and a lot of venues to play, and you have this concentration of talent and audience that's interested.
Now, what would the 23-year-old Michael Dorf have thought of a Zappa and Zinfandel night?
You know, I might not have known what Zinfandel was, and Gary Lucas certainly turned me on to what Zappa was. So
Gary Lucas, New York-based guitarist and a regular of the Knitting Factory, both the club and your record label of that name.
Yeah, he did a lot, and he's a great guitar player, and I think he did turn me on to some Zappa I'd never heard of in Wisconsin.
Well, Zappa and Zinfandel, that's one of this.
We have a lot of fun where we try and pair music and wine together. And, you know, everyone talks about music and or wine and cheese and mm-hmm. wine. We take it one step further. It's all very subjective, but we have a lot of fun with doing these pairings.
Get your Zinfandel ready. Here's some Zappa.
This has to be the disease for you. Now, scientists call this disease bromidrosis, but us regular folks who might wear tennis shoes or an occasional python boot know this exquisite little inconvenience by the name of stink butt. You know, my python boot is too tight. I couldn't get it off last night. A week went by, and now it's July. I finally got it off, and my girlfriend cried. You got stink butt. Stink foot, darling. Your stink foot puts a hurt on my nose. Stink foot, I ain't lying. Can you rinse it off, do you suppose?
Frank Zappa, Stinkfoot from 1974's Apostrophe, and Zappa and Zinfandel is part of the pairing of wine and music that Michael Dorff has been having some fun with across the street at City Winery. 10 years of rock tribute concerts continuing on March 31st at Carnegie Hall with a tribute to Paul Simon. Are you still interested in experimental music?
A little less so, I have to be honest. Yeah. I still will put on some great free jazz and I'm going back to some artists that, you know, sadly have reached the end of their career or aren't living anymore. Mm-hmm. And
like who?
Well, Roy Campbell, who mm-hmm. passed away 6 months ago. So this last weekend at home, I pulled out all these Roy Campbell records and listened to them and, you know, got sentimental. Mm-hmm. We just did a little Thomas Chapin tribute at City Winery. I feel actually sometimes even a little guilty to not be supporting more experimental and some of what was associated with the Knitting Factory.
Right.
A lot
I mean,
of
Thomas
friends.
Chapin, I think I only knew Thomas Chapin because of you.
I did a lot with Thomas, and sadly he died, you know, prematurely at 41 from cancer. And I miss all those guys, you know, and it was a great scene. But for the most part, you know, we found our niche, you know, with the singer-songwriter work. And
right. Is there any place in Manhattan that could afford to do that at this point? Or do you have to go across the river or upstate at this point?
Yeah, I think they are. There's a great scene in Brooklyn. But unless it's got some sort of institutional support, Jazz and Lincoln Center or whatever, you're just really not going to see it anymore in Manhattan.
And that kind of quote-unquote downtown free jazz, that is not getting the support of Jazz at Lincoln Center.
You know, John Zorn's doing it at the Stone. And thank God for that, right?
Yep.
But that's a philanthropic effort, and otherwise it would be very, very challenging. And so, you know, he's a real savior.
Right, John Zorn, the composer who founded The Stone. We've been speaking with Michael Dorff, who founded the original Knitting Factory, now based in Brooklyn, and more recently City Winery, which is currently here in New York across the street and in Chicago, opening soon in Napa and in Nashville. And his annual tribute concert series at Carnegie Hall continues on March 31st, honoring this year the songs of Paul Simon. Michael, have a good time that night, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Soundcheck. Music from the late Thomas Chapin, going back to Michael Dorff's old Knitting Factory days there, and a song called One Man Blues from the album Radius. Tomorrow on the show, two different looks at the sprawling reach of American hip-hop. First, Steve Stout has turned his book, The Tanning of America, into a new documentary about the rise of hip-hop in mainstream culture. And we first heard about the rapper and producer Leaf during a visit from an avowed fan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz. Now Leaf himself joins us to perform and talk about his rapid-fire technique, his favorite rising stars, and about being openly gay in the world of hip-hop. All of that coming up tomorrow on Soundcheck. That'll do it for the program today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.